The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, talking all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring. I'm your co-host, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette. How's it going?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're gone for a week or so.
Yeah, but you left me high and dry this morning on Jay Oliver.
Oh, poor you. He likes you better than me anyway. At least that's what he said.
That's what you say about almost everybody.
Well, on my way to a detention center in Manhattan or in Brooklyn, I heard him say, I like getting you on just alone. So maybe I'll give him that opportunity every Monday morning.
Wonderful. You know, an MDC has housed many, many famous an inmate, right? But speaking of famous and facing misfortunes, we've got a lot of news on Crime and Justice Radio. We have a judge threatening to jail Rudy Giuliani. The Santa Fe district attorney has strongly hinted she may bring homicide-related charges against Alec Baldwin. Attorney General Letitia James just filed a civil suit against Trump, claiming he inflated.
Claiming he's a massive
liar
from beginning to end, right? Something we didn't know.
And we have opening arguments set to begin in Michael Valva, the NYPD officer charged with the depraved indifference murder of his 8-year-old son, scheduled to begin on Wednesday morning. And our partner, John Leterco,
he's a lead defense attorney. So we'll see how that goes. Horrible case that we've talked about a few times, but a horrible case, horrible result does not mean that the individual deserves the maximum punishment and the conviction on the top count. So we'll see how that happens. Of the things you mentioned, what I find most curious is Giuliani, who didn't show up for court on Friday judgment.
So many cases going on. It's hard for them to keep track of
that's
them.
That's exactly what he
said. I was in Georgia testifying in the grand jury. They treated me very nicely. But apparently he totally skipped out on matrimonial court. And
he said he didn't know about it, wasn't given notice, that he's never missed a court date, that he, you know, has all these things going on all over the place.
That happens to lawyers, though.
It does from time
to time. And it certainly happens to those who are accused or plaintiffs and defendants.
I guess. But if he doesn't pay $235,000 by October 7th, the judge said he's going to regretfully put Mr. Giuliani in Rikers until he pays the money. And I'll tell you what.
Judges do this.
We don't advertise doing divorce work, but from time to time we've done it. And I can say that more than one white-collar, upstanding individual, lawyers, businessmen, have found themselves in jail for failing to pay alimony, maintenance, child support, legal fees. They think they can kind of snub their nose at the divorce courts, but the judges have quite a bit of power to hold people in contempt and summarily incarcerate them until they pay the judgments.
If you are found in criminal contempt, you can be sentenced to up to a year.
Yeah, but it's not
jail.
It's not criminal contempt. They put the individual in jail as a coercive tactic,
right,
to force them to pay the money.
So fathers or mothers who don't pay child support, if you don't pay your spouse monies that are due, etc., jail you, lock you up until you
write a check. Now they need to show willfulness, and they need to show that you obviously could pay. You've just chosen not to.
So you found, of all the things that I said, that one being the most curious. But do you know what I found most curious? As I was reading about Giuliani and why exactly he was being held in contempt, I was reading an article, I think it was NBC, that indicated that Rudy and his wife were married for 15 years. I kind of didn't realize they were divorcing, that he had been previously married for 20 years to Donna Hanover, the mother of his two children. But before that,
I knew this.
He was married for 14 years to his second cousin, Regina Perugi. that marriage was annulled.
Yes. Well, it's
a little known secret about Giuliani.
I don't know if it's a secret, but it might not be as well known as some other things. Look, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody's morality because of failed marriages, but it is curious that the crazy Republican, moral police end up with multiple spouses and failing to pay.
I think that's kind of a gross overstatement. Trump has
what, three wives?
And they all love him and support him.
Yeah, I'm sure. the thing I found curious about that was that there's a book out from a number of years ago, and I forget the political pundit who wrote it, although I've spoken to him a few times. It's called Everything That Trump Touches Dies.
True.
And everybody who's around Trump's orbit, who doesn't get away from him, ends up with unbelievable problems. I mean, for me,
the most shocking is the lawyers that end up with unbelievable problems, because as advocates, we take on a position. Obviously, that means we have to follow the law, follow our ethics, and we can't make misrepresentations on the record. But it is stunning to me that I live in a universe where attorney-client privilege no longer exists, where lawyers are audio recording conversations they have with their clients, where someone who potentially in good faith takes a position and offers affidavits and corroborating evidence can be disbarred.
I think the good faith part is where they get lost. I mean, it's kind of the devil's advocate, that old movie with Al Pacino, where the lawyer who wants to do the right thing and wants to follow the rules gets sucked in to doing the wrong thing in order to impress somebody. And the name of the book is Everything That Trump Touches Dies, written by Rick Wilson.
So I would be afraid to be touched by Trump or to represent him, so to speak. But I don't think I would mind representing Alec Baldwin if he was charged in the...
Good transition. Yeah.
It's a great transition, Bruce. And I'm actually fascinated because we were talking about this in the elevator. And apparently the Santa Fe prosecutor provided a letter to the financial board asking for more funding on her investigation as to what transpired on the set of Rust and whether or not to charge individuals. And in doing so, she requested $650,000, claiming that she is close to charging potentially 1 to 4 individuals. She said, "We've never had a trial schedule of that magnitude. These are all homicide-related offenses, potentially, and may include Alec Baldwin." Right?
Well, look, Alec Baldwin pointed a gun that was loaded, that I'm sure he didn't know at the time was loaded, and fired it, and it ended up killing somebody. So what charges would he face?
So here's...
Not for pulling the trigger, but for being supervisor and the producer.
I'm just totally speculating, right? And we have the Emmy.
Well, but it's not speculation. We know what the law is, and we understand where criminal liability might
lie. Right, but I don't
know
what's in the Emmy report. Right. I don't know what the FBI report says. The sheriff's report is nearing completion. I don't have all the actual facts other than what the media has reported. But based on what I've learned so far, if he was a producer, if he was prominently in charge, if there had been other misfirings and accidents putting other people in grave danger, risk of death, and if that was brought to his attention and people complained again and again, and he still haphazardly grabbed a gun, didn't check, and fired it, even if it was accidental, the prosecutor could try, maybe it's a stretch, to
prove negligence.
Yeah, criminally negligent homicide.
Look, criminal negligence is a gross deviation from an ordinary standard of care where you knew or should have known that the harm could result. So a gross deviation from the standard of care, you're on a movie set. There's no reason in the world to have live ammunition there. And apparently what was happening, and this is not speculation, this is from reports, what was happening was that they had live ammunition because on breaks and days off, they'd go off into the desert, something that
we've done.
We've done.
And we've done it near Santa Fe.
Right. Yeah, in New Mexico, go off into the desert and shoot at bottles or targets or whatever. And that's all fine and good, but you can't keep live ammunition and blanks around the same guns and then not be able to tell the difference. So if I'm the producer of that movie, and I'm there, my rule would be no live ammunition on set ever, no matter what. You want to go shooting in the desert, do it with your own guns and your own ammunition. Don't have any live ammunition on our set.
That would resolve the problem 100%. I also think there's an ego element involved. Obviously, it was tradition and they used real guns before. But as you say, now everything's digitalized. You don't actually, with the technology that we have to use real ammunition. But I think there's this kind of ego verite involvement with the actors and producers that enjoy being on set with a real gun that helps them get into character because they're holding a real gun, because they're dealing with potentially real ammunition. And I really do think that there's some kind of sexy allure to that, to people on set, to actors that normally wouldn't have guns, whereas real gun owners would probably never allow that on a set.
Right. No, there's no way we'd have guns anywhere, ammunition and real guns on a movie set. It just seems crazy. And that's my guess as to where his criminal liability would find. But I don't want to skip past Trump too fast, because he's had his own set of problems this week with Letitia James bringing a massive, like 235-page fraud lawsuit against him for just being a flagrant fraud, which of course he is, right? There's just no, there's some things that are just basic truths, which is that Trump lies. Trump is a fraud. He's not nearly as rich as he pretends to be. He has defrauded almost everybody he's ever dealt with. He doesn't pay his bills, sues people constantly, is sued constantly. And Letitia James sort of brought all of this together in one massive lawsuit,
which including his children as named defendants. And just to give a few details from the lawsuit, where she claims that Mr. Trump used objectively false numbers to calculate property values, including counting his Trump Tower apartment at 30,000 square feet when it was 10,900 square feet, so that it could be improperly valued at $327 million.
Well, and he also valued it per square foot as $30,000 per square foot when the nearest apartment, the only apartment in New York City that ever was valued at over $100 million, was in one of those really tall new office buildings at the very top. It had a value of $10,000 per square foot, and it got was put at just over $100 million. So just absolutely ridiculous.
What do you think about charging his children?
Well, they were all part of the scheme. They sit around and they look. The reason why they did this continue to do it, I'll get to that in a second, is to get more favorable terms from banks. In other words, get interest rates and lending terms from banks that they could never have otherwise qualified for, and to get insurance companies to provide policies for coverage well in excess of the actual value of the property in case anything ever happened to it. And his children just seem to be part of the scheme that went along with it.
Just seem to be. I mean, I think you have to have more than that. And you're dealing with like...
alleged to have been. I mean, how about that if I use that legal term?
It's not like they drafted the paperwork and not sure that they all reviewed it.
I read the complaint.
You have CPAs, you have accountants responsible for the claims. So she ultimately has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, which isn't as high a standard as proof beyond a reasonable doubt as you would have in a criminal case, that Trump knew the figures.
He personally signed off on them. He clearly knew them. There's testimony from Michael Cohen, that his one-time fixer and lawyer, that they walked in and Trump said, I want my net worth or my worth to be in excess of, I forgot the exact figure, but instead of $4 billion, I want it to be $7 billion. And they just went around cooking up numbers to get him from four to seven. And Ivanka Trump signed some of the documents, submitted some of the there's emails, there's some documentation that the kids, these adults who benefited from their father's fraud, were intimately involved in doing this.
Now,
the problem I see with the case, to be honest with you,
it's political.
Well, two things. One, Letitia James, who we've repeatedly invited to come on the show. So I hope she will take us
up. Offer still stands.
Offer still stands. We're not bad people. I want her to come on and talk about this, talk about bail reform, criminal justice reform, and answer some questions. I think she should be given an opportunity to explain herself, that she campaigned on going after Trump, which has been roundly criticized across the political spectrum as being a mistake, because it gives Trump a huge target to claim that this is all political. So we'd love to hear from Letitia.
You sound like the Wall Street Journal there that is quoted as saying, Ms. James ran for office promising to indict Mr. Trump, which is the opposite of the way justice should be done. You're supposed to find a crime and then identify the perpetrator. That said, aren't these similar allegations to the ones that were investigated by District Attorney Alvin Bragg in New York, but ultimately he didn't pursue
He hasn't pursued yet.
Yeah, right. But I think he pretty much let go of the grand jury investigation, thinking that he didn't have sufficient evidence. And obviously the quantum of proof is different in a criminal case. But
reading the complaint, there's no doubt that they committed these acts. There really isn't. I mean, I get they can defend themselves. I understand the burden of proof and all the rest. There's no doubt that they committed these acts. No doubt at all.
But it's all the knowledge knowingly committed
these acts.
Of course.
Of course they did. But the problem with the case is not that they, you know, overvalued his apartment by
victims.
Banks were paid. There's no victims. No insurance claims were submitted. Nobody paid out anything. Now, you're not allowed to commit this kind of fraud and then pay back on the terms. I guess the banks would say we're victims in a different way. It's not that we lost out on the millions of dollars that we loaned him. It's that we lost out on more favorable terms to us. The interest rates would have been higher.
Right.
He would have had to pay the money back quicker. We would have had tougher standards in. And they're not victims yet. So he still has debt. This debt isn't all paid off.
Pay back most of it already?
No. There's still debt out there.
Well, and Trump said he paid him back.
Right. So there's still debt out there being paid. And so we'll see what ends up happening. Before we get to the bottom of the hour, I want to introduce our next topic, which deserves a little bit more time than we're going to be able to give it. We have two great guests, or very interesting guests.
Connected.
Mark Elliott and Dr. Kiper, I believe. It's K-I-P-E-R, so hopefully I'm saying his name correctly. Mark Elliott was part of NXIVM and had credits.
Well, let's just go back. Let me explain for those who don't know NXIVM as a household name, though you might, because it was featured on HBO's show The Vow. NXIVM is, according to some, a multi-level marketing corporation that taught life skills, or according to others, it's a cult run by Keith Raniere, who was criminally convicted for a pattern of racketeering, human trafficking, sex offenses, forced labor, and fraud. And I think a lot of people associate NXIVM as promising to help individuals overcome any kind of life challenges, but behind closed doors was also branding women or running...
Branding women.
And running like fear experiments and forced labor and kind
sex
of like you weren't allowed to eat during certain hours and so forth. But we actually had two whistleblowers of NXIVM who at least one of I've known practically my whole life. I went to boarding school with him. I went to Brown University with him. Anthony Ames and his wife, Sarah Edmondson, who was actually branded, were among the first to get NXIVM and Keith Raniere to the attention of the FBI. And an investigation ensued, ultimately culminating in Keith Raniere's conviction and sentence to 120 years. Tonight, we're going to hear from Mark Elliott, who is a supporter of Keith Raniere, who's an American author and learned how to overcome Tourette's syndrome.
And it wasn't just him. It's several, yeah, several individuals.
At least a dozen others, it is claimed, through the help of Nixium and talking tactics led by hypnotherapist Saltzman and Keith Raniere, overcame that. And he is introducing us to Dr.
James Kuiper.
Yeah, it's Dr. James Richard Kuiper, who is a 20-year veteran of the FBI. I think he's the force behind the FBI Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2016. And he just recently provided information on how the FBI tampered with forensic digital evidence in Keith Raniere's case that resulted in his wrongful conviction.
We're going to be right back with those guests after a short break. Be sure to follow us on all our social media platforms, Instagram at Crime Justice Radio, Twitter at Crime Justice FM. Like us on Facebook, Crime and Justice Radio. And of course, you can listen to the shows. Go to BarquetteEpstein.com and you can listen to the past shows. Maybe go back and hear the show of your buddy
Anthony
Nippy Ames
and Sarah Edmondson, exactly, of HBO's The Vow.
We'll be back with Dr. James Kuiper and Mark Elliott right after the break.
Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette. And we have the pleasure of introducing two fascinating and riveting guests. Let me start off with Mark Elliott, who's an American author. He wrote a book, What Makes You Tick? My Journey from Tourette's to Tolerance, as well as he was featured in a short documentary on YouTube called My Tourette's, that demonstrated how working with Nixium, a marketing self-improvement organization,
or a sex trafficking cult.
We'll discuss, helped cure him of Tourette syndrome, which I don't disbelieve and I think is so fascinating. I want to know more. But we also have Dr. Richard Kuiper, who is 20 years retired FBI agent, special agent, who is a computer forensics examiner, a unit chief of the FBI Academy in Quantico, and the force behind the FBI Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2016, who will tell us how forensic digital evidence was potentially manipulated in the trial of Nixium leader Keith Raniere, who was since convicted and sentenced to 120 years. How'd I do, gentlemen?
Good evening. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mark, Dr. Kuiper, yeah. Are you both there?
Yeah, we are both here. A pleasure to meet both of you. Thank you for having us on tonight.
Oh, thank you. I guess we have to start with Mark. We're going to get to the doctor and his affidavit that was submitted in support of a motion to vacate Keith Raniere's conviction in the Eastern District of New York in federal court here. Mark, I watched the documentary Tourette's. Unbelievably gripping and fascinating and moving to watch a number of individuals. I think there was four or five, maybe six people depicted, you among them, on how each of you suffered with Tourette's for most of your lives, how it was crushing to your families and to your loved ones, and then to see you overcome it. Can you tell us how Nixium did that?
Absolutely. I mean, as you can imagine, it has been an incredible journey with the Tourette's. And I just, I know in the introduction you had said how, you know, Nixium had cured us. And I just want to be really clear is that, you know, Nixium didn't cure anyone with Tourette's, and it was nothing that we publicized in that way. What had happened is simply is I had, you know, a severe case of Tourette's for 20 years. It was debilitating. I tried all sorts of things. And luckily, I was introduced to Executive Success Programs, which is one of the companies under the umbrella of Nixium. And it was through these tools I was able to look at myself and my Tourette's in a way that no other doctor in the world had ever helped me see. And so through, you know, a lot of hard work and just these extraordinary tools to help people build self-awareness and have certain, through philosophical inquiries, perceptual shifts, I was able to do, you know, the unimaginable and basically beat my Tourette's completely mind over body. And in the documentary, you see this, and it was, we were able to replicate that actually with 10 other people. The documentary only shows 5 of them, but it's through the tools, within Nexium, it clearly had a profound impact on the people with Tourette syndrome. But it wasn't a cure in the sense of, you know, these people were given a pill. It was people that were open, that wanted to grow, that wanted to see if there was other ways that they could beat their Tourette's. And through these courses, they found a way to do so.
I read and I saw in part of the documentary that prior to being open to this methodology and skill set that you developed that help you overcome the challenges of Tourette syndrome, you tried everything else. You tried hypnosis, you were medicated. Can you tell us about what you did before, if it failed?
Absolutely.
And how it was that you got connected with the executive success programs and why you were open to the possibility? Like, what made you go, yeah, I'm going to invest my time in this because I truly believe it might have an impact?
Yeah, I had tried everything under the sun, as you said, medication, which for many people have horrific side effects, mostly sleeping all the time. For me, I had even done Botox injections in my face, in my throat, in my neck, biofeedback, neurobiofeedback. I had done everything. And so by the time I was, you know, 20, 21, 23, I still had pretty severe Tourette's where, you know, a lot of people, like about half of people with Tourette's, it kind of subsides and grows out. They grow out of it. That clearly was not the case for me. And so I actually ended up becoming an inspirational speaker with Tourette's, talking about compassion and tolerance around the nation, really believing I was going to have Tourette's for the rest of my life. As, you know, why would I believe I wouldn't when I'm still ticking after puberty, and I'm told this is a neurological genetic disorder that's involuntary, you know, my whole life. So when I was introduced to ESP, executive success programs, it had nothing to do with Tourette's, but clearly I was an inspirational speaker helping a lot of people, and I'm a believer in, you know, if you're going to try to help other people, you want to grow as an individual yourself. And so I went to the courses just to learn about myself, ultimately to try to have, you know, more compassion for myself. I had a lot of internal demons with the Tourette's, and just by happenstance, I found that as I went on this exploration, it had a profound impact on my Tourette's. And at the very core level, I realized that my Tourette's was not, it was more, instead of it being something physiological, it was actually way more emotional and psychological. I just want to be really clear, too, is that, you know, what happened to me with respect to Nexium was not unique. It was something that, you know, over 17,000 people took these courses, and many people had just as profound of an impact. It's just with Tourette's, it's very clear. You know, it's just so, this person had Tourette's, now they don't.
You can't fake having it.
Right, right. Well, look, as with many things in life, right? It's not black or white. It's somewhat gray, potentially. And if you read the media accounts of Nexium and Ranieri, you know, you think this was a demonic cult. But you listen to you speak about it and others, and it provided some real benefit to it, whether or not Mr. Ranieri is or was guilty of the crimes that he was charged with and ultimately convicted of is a separate matter. And on that point, I want to bring in Dr. Kuiper, who, as Aida introduced, is a 20-year, was an FBI special agent for 20 years, specializing in cybersecurity and digital forensics. And he submitted a motion. Now, Mark, you wrote a letter in support of
Mr. Ranieri during his sentencing, right?
Right, exactly, during his first sentencing. And Dr. Kuiper wrote an affidavit in support of a motion to vacate the conviction. And in that regard, he writes this. It's a quick paragraph. In my 20 years serving as an FBI agent, I have never observed or claimed that an FBI employee tampered with physical evidence, digital or otherwise. But in this case, I strongly believe the multiple intentional alterations to the digital information I have discovered constitutes evidence of manipulation. And when so many human-generated alterations happen to align with the government's narrative, I believe any reasonable person will conclude that the evidence of tampering has taken place. My analysis demonstrates that some of the alterations definitely took place while the devices were in the custody of the FBI. Therefore, in the absence of any other plausible explanation, it's my expert opinion that the FBI must have been involved in this evidence tampering. Doctor, how do you support that rather profound allegation?
So here's what we can, without getting into all of the details, if you've read my report, I have technical findings and I have process findings, right? Technical findings are those things that are demonstrative. They stand on their own. They don't need any kind of inference or anything like that. Manual alterations of evidence. There are seven technical findings in that regard. And then I have process findings, which are things like mishandling of evidence, broken chain of custody, violation of CART SOPs. CART is the computer analysis response team that I used to teach for the FBI. So what can we attribute to the FBI in this case? I mean, really, the FBI definitely mishandled the evidence and broke the chain of custody in the evidence that they used. They definitely accessed the evidence without a write blocker. That we know to a scientific certainty, and it actually came out in trial. It was just never addressed. And the FBI definitely used the manipulated evidence in trial, and then definitely mischaracterized the reliability of the evidence. Well, those are the things that we can absolutely say for certain.
This wasn't small technical problems with the evidence. The claim is that they planted child pornography on Ranieri's hard drive. Is that right?
No. So the claim, I hear this a lot, that we're claiming that the FBI actually planted child pornography. That's not accurate. What they did in this case, because they had to create a connection for the jury, a connection between an external hard drive and a camera card. And on that external hard drive, they found 22 pictures of what they deemed to be child pornography, not based upon the face value or just looking at the child pornography because it was of a mature woman, but they deemed it child pornography based on timestamp, which would put the subject of those pictures at 15 years old at the time they were
and
taken.
That's Camilla, if I'm correct, right?
Right, I believe that is her name.
Who claims she was 15 when he took
all the characters in the case? Right, I kind of stay in my lane of forensics, but yes. So they did. They needed to do two things in this case. They needed to connect these alleged child pornography pictures that were found on the external hard drive. They needed to connect that to the camera and therefore to the defendant. But they also needed the jury to believe the times that they're claiming these pictures were taken. And I found all kinds of alterations that align with this particular narrative and some very bizarre findings that demonstrate to a scientific certainty that evidence was manipulated in this case.
Well, let me just ask the question that, dubious family members would pitch to me at a cocktail party. Why? If they have a complainant, a witness testifying that something took place at a particular time, making that conduct criminal, why would the FBI go through these lengths to tamper with the evidence?
That's a question I think is better for the legal team. Maybe Mark, you can jump in on that.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Why this case? You have so many cases out there. And Dr. Kuiper, you say this is the first time you've personally witnessed it in terms of the aftermath and conducting your digital examination. Why, Mark? Why Keith Raniere? Of all the cases that the FBI has to deal with, why Nixium?
Well, I think it's one of the most important questions that comes up in people's mind. Why would you do this? If you have a guilty man, if you have the evidence, why would you need to tamper and fabricate it, right? It makes no sense if you have a guilty person. And so the clearest answer is that Keith Raniere is absolutely innocent of these charges. Why would you, if you are the prosecutor, you're the EDNY, you have the FBI, you have one of the biggest investigative firms, I guess you could say, in the world. They have unlimited amount of resources, unlimited amount of people. They did this investigation over a year. It's clear if they had it, they wouldn't need to do this. And just to give more context, you know, after Keith Raniere was arrested, five other co-defendants were arrested. This went on for like almost 9 months. No one had pled guilty. While no one was pleading guilty, they were, you know, creating this. Not only was the prosecution involved with this, but the media was creating this horrific narrative that Keith Raniere and NXIVM is just this absolute monster that's hurting people. But no one was pleading guilty because ultimately these people were innocent. This was a case of a community and a group of people doing things as consenting adults. And the government came in to try to change that narrative and make consenting things illegal. And so because no one had pled guilty within, I think it was about 50 days before trial, 50 days, again, no one had pled guilty, all of a sudden the FBI accidentally finds child pornography. And once they found this child pornography that day, and within the 5 weeks before the trial, all five co-defendants pled guilty.
And a couple of them agreed to cooperate and testify against Mr. Raniere. So,
instead of it being a case of consenting adults and everyone was going to testify, you know, and go to trial to show how ridiculous this was and what the government was doing, now it became a case of not only minors, but sexual exploitation of a minor. So they did this because they had to do this. Their case was that flimsy, was that weak, that the only thing, the last Hail Mary they had was to throw in child pornography, and that's why they did it.
Can I talk about the timing of that, if you guys don't mind?
Go ahead.
Okay, so in the FBI, when you are, and I've done many, 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 many child pornography cases as a forensic examiner with the FBI, I would say over half of all the cases I've done have been child pornography. So if you are investigating another crime and you are going through the digital evidence, the examiner is, and they happen upon what they believe to be child pornography, then the protocol is to stop your search immediately and obtain additional authority in terms of a search warrant. So you get a new search warrant, then you can continue your search for child pornography. Okay, that's how it's discovered under the plain view doctrine, right?
We do this in our day jobs.
Right.
If you discover other evidence of another crime that you're not investigating, right, you're supposed to go back and get a search warrant to look for this evidence. And getting back to what I said earlier, which was kind of a broad way of putting it, they planted child pornography there. It's kind of what they did, and it's what the defense alleged that they did in the motion to vacate the verdict that you filed an affidavit in. You put a finer point on it, but the core of it is we found pictures of an underage individual on the hard drive, and what you're saying is that the timestamp on that might not corroborate the her being underage at the time the pictures were taken.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't...
Exactly right, and it's better.
But is it possible that... So, sadly, you know, it's too bad we live in a world that... anyone on either side of law enforcement has to deal with child pornography cases in the first instance. But is it possible that in this case, because as you described the photograph, she was a mature looking woman, you know, this isn't a minor child that we're dealing with. Whereas if you're an FBI agent, you come across a picture of a 7-year-old, that's clear, obvious, blatant child pornography that you would stop, get an additional search warrant for, et cetera, and track and take note of your steps. Is it possible that this was overlooked and then they went back and when they were, you know, trying to get the timestamps and trying to corroborate the complainant's own testimony that they discovered?
Well, let me tell you about the timeline of this discovery. So in January of 2009, the prosecutors went to the court, and they said that they were going to file a superseding indictment with new charges. That was January of 2019. February, the next month, is when the child pornography was discovered, okay? And he rightly got another search warrant and went forward. In March is when the government filed their superseding indictment, and the only new charges were child exploitation. So how did the question is, how did the prosecutors know before they discovered child pornography that they were going to supersede with child pornography? That's a charges?
Great question. Mark, if we only have a minute or two left, can I ask, are you still in touch with Keith Raniere?
No, I'm fortunately not still in touch with Keith after we have filed the Rule 33, you know, to the court exposing this historic level of tampering. The BOP has completely retaliated against him, has cut him off. They initially scrubbed his phone list, and then even, unfortunately, about 8 weeks ago, he was the victim of an attack, and he was punched, left unconscious, and he went to the SHU, which is normal protocol, but the BOP has actually cleared him of any wrongdoing. And they have continued to hold him in the SHU.
Which, they claim for one's own protection, but it's punishment nonetheless. We're running out of time, so this is a kind of an obnoxious question for me to ask last minute. But let me ask you, Mark. I understand that organizations and people can have wonderful, generous characteristics, right? But as Bruce said, things aren't always black and white, they're gray. Is it possible that you've experienced the best, but just were never privy to the worst dark criminal underpinnings of Keith Raniere?
Yeah, what I can tell you is I've only experienced the most wonderful people and never saw anything nefarious. Some people believe that because I had positive results, I have the inability to critically think and call out something, a criminal act that they might have done. And I have no problem doing that. What I know and what many other incredible and well-renowned attorneys know in the nation, that if you look at the specific charges against Keith Raniere in this trial, there is no evidence to support it.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on. We're literally out of time. It's a fascinating discussion. I hope you come back as the story develops and the courts rule. We'll see you next week or speak to you next week on Crime and Justice Radio. Same time, same station.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.